aliens and flying saucers.
Hey, what's up? Happy New Year. Welcome to the 31st episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, author of multiple New York Times bestsellers, and a columnist for The Athletic. The music you're listening to is Croissant's Master by the great MC White Owl. And this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from journalism to songwriting to screenwriting to novels to romance to comics to whatever genre I'm thinking of. And today's guest is Tyler Kepner, the longtime New York Times baseball writer and a guy I've known for many, many moons. Tyler and I broke into the business right around the same period, and I followed his career from California to Seattle to the New York Times. And today, we're going to talk about baseball reporting, about finding angles other people miss. We'll also delve into Tyler's longtime antagonism toward Alex Rodriguez, as well as his odd love of Manny Trio. So let's play ball right now on Two Writers, Sling and Yang. Tyler.
Yes.
Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome.
So wait, true or false, you are, as we speak, in your own book writing hell bunker.
It's not really hell, but it's kind of nice, actually, because I've been looking forward all year to having some time just me up in this place in New Hampshire that's in our family, and just kind of concentrating on nothing but the book, which so it's nice. It's harder when you're distracted and going in a million different directions.
So are you able, this is the first book you've written, it's an exploration in the history of pitching, you're writing for Doubleday, I presume it's due relatively soon, is it, how much time do you have left?
Up until spring training starts, really. The whole manuscript in March 1st, but that'll be in the middle of spring training, so I'm going to do it, a month before then, probably.
So are you able to sit down, you're by yourself, are you able to sit down, not go on Twitter, not go on Facebook, not go anything, and just write for 5-6 hours? Do you have the sort of discipline I lack?
Well, no, you're the you're the master. You can teach us all how to do it. But I think everybody just has their own process, I guess. I'll have the other apps up and stuff, or the other websites up, just for a little bit of a distraction, but not. I'm learning. Like, I can't. I've been trained to write, 1,000-word, 900, 1,200-word articles. So once I, once I kind of reach that, I'll just need to do something to break it up, but then I can come right back to it. I'm trying to if I'm up here 5 days, then I try to do, 2,000 words a day, let's say, and then it's 10. So that's a chapter. And then maybe at night, try to go revise some of the other older chapters that I've done and get them right. So I'm finding the groove.
Yeah. Early on in my, when I was working on my first book, I got some really good advice from John Wertheim at SI, because he had just written a book about the Williams sister. He just said, if you think of it as 100,000 words, it's going to overwhelm you and probably depress you. But if you think of every chapter as a long magazine article, mentally, it changes it. And I still think of that for myself. That every chapter is just a long magazine piece. Mm-hmm. It just makes it easier for me, at least. I don't know.
That definitely makes sense. I mean, I kind of feel that way too.
So I'm staring. I'm sitting here. Actually, this is weird, but I'm sitting in a car in a parking lot at a coffee shop in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
I thought you'd be in California or something. But
no, I'm in Florida, and I'm looking at an article, November 14th, 1989. Magazine has youth on its side.
Sure, I like that. Yeah, that was good. That was fun.
Yeah, so the lead is, like any 14-year-old pitcher outfielder with a high batting average, a low earned run average, and two most valuable player awards, Tyler Kepner loved to play in the big leagues. Good as he is, however, Kepner, freshman at Germantown Academy in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, knows he is not major league material. Fortunately, he has a fallback ambition. I'd like to be a sports writer, he said the other day, modestly overlooking the fact that he already is one of the best. Kepner is a founder, president, publisher, editor, writer, and just about everything else of KP Baseball Monthly, the country's fastest growing, most imaginatively written baseball magazine with a hand-colored cover. So when you were a kid, you used to make this 24-page baseball magazine by on your own, with the dream of ultimately becoming a baseball writer. And here we are. And when I was a kid, my dream was to become a sports writer, just like you. And I wrote for my high school newspaper, and I used to tell my mom I'm going to write for Sports Illustrated and blah blah blah. And she always would say, "Be realistic," and I'd say, "Oh, I really think I'm going to do this." And I always wonder when I talk to people like you. So here you are now. It's 2017. You're almost 30 years removed from that article. Has it been worth it? Has it lived up to what you thought it would be?
Oh yeah, definitely. No question about it. I got an early preview for what it would be just shortly after that, really the next year when I started interviewing players and going to the, clubhouse and getting credentials and everything. So really right after that is when I just knew that I would be comfortable in that environment and that I would, or as comfortable as you can be in that environment, and that it was for me. So I know it has. It continues to I think challenge me creatively, and I never get tired of baseball. You and I have discussed that. So
Yeah, I don't get it.
yeah,
I actually
that's the
don't get
biggest
it.
thing
I've
for me.
never
Because
understood it.
if I didn't like, I always say to these, people in baseball, man, if you don't really love the sport and love what you're doing, man, don't do it because it's so all consuming because it's every day. So it's not worth doing. But I, if I didn't love it, I wouldn't, if I didn't love it, I'd probably hate it. But I don't think there's much in between. But I love baseball, so it's a perfect thing for me to do.
Wait, I want to go back. How did you actually? I'm sure we talked about this years and years ago, but you're 14 or whatever you are, and you start this magazine. How did you actually go from starting a local magazine to getting credentialed for clubhouses as a kid?
Well, let me try to think exactly. I mean, I developed it to where it got some publicity, so it had a little bit of credibility that way, and that other people were writing about it and taking notice of it. But as far as taking the next step to start doing interviews, I was lucky. I knew some people with the Phillies who put some faith in me that I could handle myself in that kind of situation, and they started me off really with kind of baby steps. I did my first interview in spring training on the backfield there in Clearwater, just a one-on-one with a pitcher named Pat Combs, and
Oh yeah. What year was this?
that was 90. It was the day after I turned 15.
Okay. What do you remember about that? You and Pat Combs, 1990.
What's that?
What do you remember about your first interview with the legendary Pat Combs in 1990?
He was the hot thing back then, man. I think he had gone through every level of the farm system the year before, and he was like, he had a great September, and it was a first round pick, and he was really nice. He was a really, and I still correspond with him now and then, but he was just super nice and down to earth and a young guy. And later that year, when I was on the field at the vet, I had a credential. They were the network was doing a segment on me, and they credentialed me to go around with him. And he kind of tugged on my shirt from the dugout, and he remembered me, which I thought was really cool. And
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think people. I have found this probably since the beginning that people, especially in baseball, they can sense if you're sincere or if you're insincere, and if you think you know it all, or if you genuinely want to know what they know and know more. If you're, I think people have, I mean, I hope people have always sort of sensed that sincerity about me. And I think he did, because I could have been, I don't know, I could have been really intimidated or whatever, but I always tried to prepare a lot beforehand. I felt like, and I still feel like preparing a lot makes me, takes away some of the nerves when I'm doing an interview. And also, as I went along interviewing guys, I just found out that it was weird. It was like they looked just like they look on TV. There was nothing really surprising about the situation, about how they looked or how they how you interacted with them, as long as you just showed the proper respect. You know, nobody doing what kind of publication I was working for. So I would bring one along and show them and explain what I wanted and you know, ask politely. And you'd be surprised, maybe not you, but I mean, a lot of people would be surprised how just being polite and respectful, how much that can help. I don't know. We don't have enough of that now, but yeah, I just always try to be really respectful and polite and err on that side of the coin.
Did you feel that having that experience and sort of doing it when you were young? Like, I feel like when I started covering baseball, it took me several years, just being honest, to get completely past the nerves of walking up to certain players in a clubhouse and not knowing if hostility was coming. And I wonder, I've seen you in action many times through the years, and you never really seem to have that. Or am I just totally misreading the situation?
No, I think when I first went into it, I expected everybody to be a jerk, just because I think that's the way that the media, unfortunately, is portrayed in the media, in the movies and stuff. It's always portrayed as adversarial, and that they hate us and we hate them or whatever. And it's so not the case, in my experience. It's much, at least in baseball, it's much more collegial than it is adversarial or nasty. But, you know, when I was 15, I just expected a lot of guys to be kind of rude. And so I had really low expectations. And then they were just the opposite, for the most part. And look, I wasn't asking them tough questions, right? I mean, I wasn't like, if I'm writing my own magazine, I'm making my own rules and I'm my own boss. So generally, if I'm going to do a story on you, it's going to be pretty positive, you know, because those are the better players. But yeah, there were still some negative things I had to ask some time, but I don't know, it worked out. I mean, it, you know, it was just a gradual process. I went from doing that first interview with Pat Holmes to doing some on-field, having just like field passes and then eventually clubhouse passes. And I give the Phillies, you know, a lot of credit for that. Larry Schenck was the PR man there at the time. Dave Montgomery knew my dad. They had been in the Army Reserves together growing up. So I think he told Larry just to give me a shot and see. And Larry gave me a shot. And I think I just kept sort of proving myself that I could handle that sort of grown up environment. And if I hadn't, you know, I don't think they would have invited or allowed me to come back. But I think it was just a matter of, you know, having somebody help me get in the door and then just showing people that I knew how to handle myself.
Right. You seem like a guy who does not and has never cared about being famous. Like, you don't seem – you've never struck me as a writer who's particularly interested in his curating or getting recognized by so-and-so or having extensive time on TV. And I wonder, am I misreading that, or do you just not care? It's because it just seems like it's about the baseball to you more than anything.
Yeah, it always has been. I mean, I'd be lying if I said I got into it, because I wanted to be the next, you know, Woodward and Bernstein or whatever. I mean, I love that movie. you know, it's one of my favorite movies, but, it's more, again, you and I have had this conversation. It's more like the kid in Almost Famous who he loves writing, but he really loves music. And that's what he can do in the music scene. You can't never see him playing an instrument or even trying to, but he wants to be a part of that world and he finds his niche within it. And I think I just always wanted to be a part of that world. And I tried, you know, I played, I was okay in high school and you know, I actually worked for the Phillies one summer, as an intern in their public relations office. The one summer in college where I didn't get an internship for a newspaper. And I think I could have, you know, been an asset. They would have liked me to come back. But it was just, that wasn't my sort of calling or my greatest strength. And I felt like what I could contribute to baseball is the ability to report on it and write on it and tell the stories within it. So that's why I wanted to be in it. But it's funny, like, since you asked me a similar question a few years ago, in the Quaz, which is still the best interview anyone's ever done with me. I'll show it to people and say, like, you want to know about me here, you know, read this. But since you asked me, I started to question that and whether I was ambitious enough, because it's not about the fame, but, you know, the more you can, I hate saying build your brand, but the more you can put yourself out there, the more money you can make, and just the more of a safety net you can have, you know, if something happens in your career. So, so I've really tried since then to spread myself out a little more. You know, I like doing stuff for, MLB Network Radio. I have a lot of fun with that, when I can. And, you know, MLB Network, occasionally they'll have me on and too. But mostly it's just this book, you know, been pouring myself into this book, for the last 3 years, and, kind of making it my life's work almost, to this point anyway. So, you know, I've been trying to put my name out there, but it's certainly not in the image of, you know, ego gratification or fame or whatever, because that doesn't really do anything for me. It's nice to be recognized always,
sure.
But it's not for the fame. It's more just, you know, for just because I think it's smart for your career.
Yeah, I agree. I also think it's interesting. I think about this a lot. I had this talk with Howard Bryant a long time ago, so you and I entered the business right around the same time. I might have been a year or two ahead of you, I'm not sure. And if you look around, if you somehow found a picture of the people who are standing around, whatever, Lou Piniella with the Seattle Mariners back in whatever, 2002 or 2001 or whatever, 1998.
Yeah.
Very few of them are still covering sports. Like, it's like people do not last super long in this business. And I wonder, do you think it's because your passion for it has kept you around? You know, have there been moments where you're like, maybe I'll go work in PR, maybe I'll go work for a team, you know, since you've been a reporter, newspapers, obviously, you know, the struggles are real, media, the struggles are real. You're kind of a survivor in a business that loses people at a pretty alarming rate.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that I, agree. I mean, there's a lot of people, at least in the New York baseball writing market who've been at it a long time and have been doing a really good job for a long time. Now, sometimes they've had job changes, and a few have had to leave the industry. But I think there's a lot of people, you know, who maybe I'm overstating it, but it feels like there's a lot of people who've been at it, you know, as long as I have. But so I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's that notable. I mean, this has been my 21st year since I started at the Riverside Press Enterprise in 98. And then you add a few more magazine. So I guess I guess that's
you've been around.
I think I've been around. Yeah, I guess it's a little bit of a survivor. I mean, I'm 42. Around. I feel like I've been doing it since I was 15. So I've been a lot more than half my life.
Yeah, yeah. I'm fascinated by a period of your career. It's one of my favorite periods of your career because it's such an interesting time, which is you covered the Seattle Mariners for the Post Intelligencer with when you had both Griffey and A-Rod in the same clubhouse. And through the years, especially when he was with the Yankees later in his career, you weren't very shy. You were never shy in your sort of takes on A-Rod. You never really seemed to enjoy that much. And I wonder what a young A-Rod and a young, not as young, but a, you know, early in his career-ish, Ken Griffey, what it was like to cover them, what it was like to cover those teams, and what it's like to cover two superstars sort of at the same time in their primes.
Yeah, it's that was maybe the most interesting team I've ever covered. Just it was the only I was a beat writer for 12 years. One covering the Angels, one with the Mariners, two with the Mets, and eight with the Yankees. And that was the only losing season I ever covered. And it wasn't even that bad, really. It was 79 and 83, but they had high expectations, as you would think, with Griffey and A-Rod and Edgar Martinez and Jay Buhner and everybody, and Lou Piniella. You know, they changed ballparks that year from the Kingdome to Safeco Field, which can't be any different than those, any more different than those. They had just traded Randy Johnson. That would have been another amazing personality to deal with. They changed GMs at the end of that year to Pat Gillick. I mean, so you're talking Hall of Fame type people there. I mean, Hall of Fame level baseball people in Griffey, A-Rod, Edgar Martinez, Piniella in a way, when you think of his whole career, Pat Gillick, I mean, Jamie Moyer pitched for longer than just about anybody whoever lived. So just a lot of big personalities there, and guys on the beat who were since the 80s and, you know, really weren't that excited about having a new guy on the beat. So it was just a strange and really challenging and fun atmosphere the whole year. But yeah, specifically about Griffey and A-Rod, it was weird because as the years went on, I appreciated Junior a whole lot more, and I kind of flipped on my opinions of them as the years went on. Griffey and I had a tough start, but we ended up being really, you know, having mutual respect and being really cool with each other.
What made a tough start? Why did you have a tough start with Junior?
And with Alex, it was kind of the opposite. I think he had heard from one of the other beat writers that, you know, who was very territorial. He didn't really like I said, he didn't really like having a new guy around. And I think he put out some misinformation about me, and Griffey really trusted him. So, you know, that, that didn't help at the beginning. And I think Griffey also, at least the feeling I got back then was just, you know, he wanted to test you a little bit and make sure you could hang in, with, the, you know, just the joking and all the stuff that goes on in the house. I mean, he, you know, he's a guy, he wants to know, well, how do I say this? You know, he wants to know you as a person, and part of the way of doing that is through sort of clubhouse humor, and that's not always the easiest thing to handle. But once you get to know him, and once you could sort of just put up with it, and you could be kind of a real person with him, that's what he was looking for. Because he was always been famous his whole life since he was born with the name. And I think he was always just looking for the opposite, which was just not anonymity exactly, because he never really wanted to just blend into the clubhouse, but he just wanted to know you and know what you were really after and just know you as a person. And whereas A-Rod was just, I always thought if he was, because he would ask you more questions and he'd be more sort of eager to please in a way. But then over time, it just sort of came to me to seem like it was, you know, putting on an act, because I never knew what personality I was going to get from him that particular on any given day, especially as time went on. And it was just sort of dizzying to try to keep up with the many personalities that you might get. Whereas Griffey and even Randy, when I covered him with the Yankees, they were just what you see is what you get. And if they're in a good mood, everybody knows it. If they're in a bad mood, everybody knows it, but they're kind of the same guy every day. I mean, they're real every day, I should say. Alex, I just never knew what was real and what wasn't.
Right, I came to really enjoy your takes on A-Rod with the Yankees, because I always thought they were really interesting and really pointed and really smart. I have one in front of you, February 17th, 2015. Tents are perfect for the circus. Yeah. If Alex Rodriguez had used one for his latest apology, he might as well have shown up in grease paint, floppy shoes, and a rainbow wig. Rodriguez, the crown prince of baseball, would be setting himself up for laughs. Nobody does slapstick like Rodriguez, who squandered his legacy in a syringe and apologized for it under the big top at the Yankees training camp in 2009. He appealed then to our better angels and said, "The only thing I ask from this group today and from the American people is to judge me from this day forward." I mean, it's really good. And, like, I just always thought you sort of – my take was you were just fed up with this guy. I mean, is that safe to say? You were just kind of fed up and didn't really feel like dealing with this guy anymore and his nonsense.
Yeah, and it's not like I'm like a steroid evangelist. I mean, if the times let me vote, I would vote for most of the steroid guys, at least in the time period before they got before they had testing. But so I'm not railing against like steroid use per se. It was more the just how he really thought he could just play everyone for fools. I mean, it was like this over the top kind of, I don't know. It was just, clownish antics one after the other. I mean, he had so many clownish antics even before the steroid stuff came out. And then the steroid stuff came out the first time. And then you're like, oh boy, there's this, you know, we got to deal with. But then once he did it again, it was like, dude, like, what the hell? Like, right. You know, people are willing to forgive, I think to some extent. They might never forget, but they're willing to forgive some stuff. But like, really? Like again? I mean, it was just so blatant and so like above the game. I mean, it's just like, we forgave you. We're not forgave. It's not a position to forgive, but like, you know, we understood the first time, I guess, and we all kind of moved past it. And now you're dragging everybody back. And it was just so much lying and so much deceit. And it was really just hard to be around. I mean, a guy who would just choose to just destroy his legacy like that and just think that we would all buy it. It was, but you know, he's charming and he knows baseball so well. He really does love baseball. I know he disgraced it, but he really does love the game. And that's why he's good on TV, because he's like, you know, he can have a charming personality and he really does know his stuff. I mean, he loves the game. I wish all that stuff had never happened, because I feel like we would have a common sort of ground about the love of the game and all that he sees in it. But after a while, Jeff, I just reached a point where there had been so much lies and so much kind of, you know, phoniness that I was just like, I don't trust what this guy says. I don't believe what he says, anything. So it's just, he lost all credibility with me. So there was kind of not a whole lot of reason to keep going to that well, because I never knew what was real.
It's actually funny. I remember, actually I evoked him earlier, but I remember John Wertheim at SI. When A-Rod was new with the Rangers, he told me the story. He went to do a profile on A-Rod, and I don't remember who it was. Maybe Jack Curry was talking to A-Rod ahead of him. And he was kind of listening in from afar, you know, standing on the side. And A-Rod told this really emotional story, and he got emotional and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the highs and the lows. And then Wertheim went up to interview him, and he told the exact same story with the exact same intonations and the exact same sort of emotion. And I remember at the time, this is way before steroids, Wertheim saying to me he never came across a less sincere athlete than Alex Rodriguez with the Texas Rangers.
I know, right?
Yeah, it's kind
of
interesting.
Yeah, now, well, you had one of the great anecdotes ever, I thought, and I think I've quoted it, because I think Verducci told you that, like, you know, when he was doing that landmark story on steroids, and, you know, Alex didn't just say, no, I've never touched him, man, that's not for me. He was like, what do they even do, Tom? Like, how would one even benefit from that? Like, I mean, he had to go over the top. Like, he couldn't just say no. A lot of guys, you know, denied it, but he had to just pretend like he was so babe in the woods about it that maybe Tom Verducci could help him understand what they would do. You know, it was just like, ugh, just don't, you know, pour it on like that.
So I'm interested, when you write something, I mean, obviously he's retired now, but when he's playing and you write something about A-Rod, do you make it a point? How much of an obligation do you feel writers have if they write something negative about someone to show their face? You know, when you would see A-Rod after writing something about him, would he bring it up to you? Was he pissed off at you? Would he pretend he never read it?
No, he never really said anything. I mean, I'm not going to rearrange my day if I have an off day or if I'm with my family or something just to show up in the clubhouse like a tough guy. But I mean, I'm there enough to where if anybody, you know, were to have something to say, I'm very easy to reach. But I always feel like if I'm writing something, that's why I'm not as, one reason why I'm not probably as harsh as a lot of other columnists are in general, is because I really just try to insert my name into the name of the subject and think about whether it's fair or not. And if I were to be confronted on it, what I could say, because I never want to be accused of taking a cheap shot, and I never want to be accused of being unfair. So I always want to make sure every criticism has, you know, a basis in, you know, something I could defend it, you know, as a way to defend it. You know, and I felt like in that case, there were just so much evidence that I felt pretty justified being harsh. And I think some people have told me, too, that because I'm usually not as harsh, that when I do take big swings, maybe they land a little harder because people aren't used to it from
I mean, it's interesting because you are not a you're not a bomb thrower, even remotely.
Right.
Yeah. You just aren't. And I wonder, like, do you look back at your career? Have you had moments where you thought that criticism was unfair or that take was unfair? Or have you had moments that you feel like you learned from, or has this always been the nature?
I mean, I've had opinions that I would have taken back. But as far as being unfair or throwing bombs, not really. The only one that comes to mind was the first one. And that was, it was just a throwaway line that I thought was kind of cute and a good image. The Angels had a pitcher named Jason Dixon who was having a tough year, and he just got lit up one day. And I said something like, you know, he looked like Charlie Brown on the mound when the ball comes back through the box, and, you know, Charlie Brown flipped over and his clothes all go flying and everything. And that was kind of a funny image. It was what I had in mind as I was watching this game. This guy just gave up all these hits. But I think I was out to dinner that night with John Lowe from a Detroit – well, not anymore. He's retired, but he was with the Detroit Free Press, just a legendary baseball writer and one of the, you know, nicest people I've ever met in my life. And, you know, he was talking about, like, well, you know, you could say that and it's fine, but, I mean, is it really fair to him if he's reading that to have himself presented that way? I mean, you can write that if you want, and you can be that kind of writer, or you can, you know, maybe pass on the stuff that would be seen as making fun of someone, because they're out there trying their hardest and they don't want to stink. And so I've really tried to, ever since then, remember that and just never take what I could perceive as a cheap shot. I really, and I also just to be careful with the language that you use, even if you don't intend it. I remember Griffey one time taking offense to the way that our columnist had phrased something. And it was just pointless way to pick a fight with someone over just a careless choice of words. You know, I want to just take good care of the words that I use. Just, I don't want to ever needlessly offend someone. I don't suspect that any of these guys are reading, but if they could, or if they did, and especially on Twitter, man, right, where it would be so easy to take a shot. I really just don't. I don't know. That's why I don't want to do it.
You know, it's interesting. You're very, very. I was trying to think when I was reading your stuff earlier today, how I would describe your writing. And I think you're very, very precise with language. Like, I have a story up here you wrote last month. First time, lifetime, Yankees Aaron Boone was probably born to manage. And your lead was, the new manager of the Yankees has a charming little parlor trick that just might help him in the dugout, period. Show Aaron Boone almost any baseball card and he can tell you where the photo was taken, comma, simply from the background details, period. By extension, long dash, and more important, long dash, he knows precisely what the player is doing, comma, two. I was thinking, like, you are not a waster of words.
Nope. Every word should have a reason, a purpose.
You're not a big adjective guy. You're not, you know, you're not laying it on. Your descriptions are not overly thick. It's not like, you know, biting through a chunk of cheesecake. Where'd you learn that from? Where's that come from?
I think I learned it. I mean, the most influential person in my writing was Jason Stark, because I read him so much as a kid, and he was the biggest influence on me professionally and as a person within the business, just the way he treats people and the respect he gives and gets. But I think where I learned it most was just being the editor of the student paper at Vanderbilt, and literally going through every word of the paper with a, you know, on the printouts with a red pen, and making sure everything fit and making sure everything sounded right. And just realizing that that there's very little I that drives me crazier than just bad writing. I mean, or unnecessary words, or just junk muddling up you know, the sentences. I mean, I really, it drives me nuts. Like, I think that's one thing that I'm never really in the office, but one thing they tell me internally is that, you know, they appreciate that I hand in really clean copy. And I think at least sometimes in the past, I've gotten a few more minutes on deadline because of it. I just really think, you should be precise with your words as much as possible and be simple, but not simplistic, kind of. I mean, Dave Anderson was a great example of that. Like, I mean, what an amazing writer. But in his style, like, he wasn't out there to, like, wow you with, like, crazy ways of overly clever ways of phrasing something. He just, you know, gave you something really readable, really good and well-reasoned and smart. And then that was it. So I don't know, but that's where I learned to do that. And I always read everything over. You know, it's the old thing. If I had time, I would have made it shorter, you know, like just say it in fewer words. I mean, I tell you, like, you know, you do a research for a book and you find some books that are, Matt bought so many books, as I researched this, and some of them have good information, but the writing just is so bad. It's just like, it's so hard to get through. And it's like, it's almost like anything, I guess, like bad sports radio, for example, is awful, but good sports radio, like when it's well done, is awesome.
Right.
Like MLB Network Radio, like the people, like they know what they're talking about. It's really good, intelligent, talk. It's like, you know, hopefully like what we're doing here. But boy, sports radio when done badly can be awful. And I think it's the same with sports writing. Like sometimes, man, it's so easy to get it wrong. But it's also not that that's not that hard to fix either. I've never felt that it was hard to say, oh man, what do I do with this? Like when I would work with writers, this goes back a long time, but like when I was sports editor of the college paper and editor, I felt like there wasn't an article that, you know, you couldn't salvage, was just moving some things around or taking some words out or making another call or two. I don't know. I just didn't feel like it was all that hard to fix either, which is why it can be so frustrating to see like, oh, like, why'd you have to write it that way? It's so easy not to do that.
Are you a big quoter? Like, do you, when you have the option of quoting or paraphrasing, do you usually go quote or do you usually go paraphrase?
I like to quote guys actually, because I feel like I've always kind of understood my place in that I'm just the byline, and that they read, you know, most of the time they read about the names underneath the byline. Now you do have to like believe in yourself and the value of your voice. And that's something I've learned as a columnist, but I think I want to know what these coaches and managers, whatnot, what they really think. They're the ones who really know it. I mean, they're the ones who live it and who've done it on the field. And I never want to lose sight of my place in relation to them. So if they have a way of explaining something that I think reads well, I'm going to use it, and I'm going to try to quote them, at length, rather than just like snip off one or two sentences, because I feel like when I talk, like in a forum like this, is good because I want every word to matter. And I feel like if a guy's talking to me and I can tell that he takes it seriously, I'd rather not shortchange him. I'd rather let him get his point across through me. Now, it's tough sometimes because you have constraints of word counts and stuff, but I'm not going to use their cliches if they use them. But I feel like most of the time, if you ask good questions and if you know your subject, you can get good answers. And if you get good answers, it's a shame to have to not use them.
Right. Yeah, that's very well said. Actually, when I was reading this story, it's funny. The story you wrote on Aaron Boone, and this came out right before he was named Yankee manager, but everyone kind of knew he would be. On the one hand, it's kind of a short story, and in your career, I imagine it's not going to go down as one of your like 20 most memorable pieces, but it's really interesting because it's really well done, and you call interesting people. Like, you called Hal McCoy, mm-hmm. who covered Aaron Boone, you know, back in the day with the Dayton newspaper, and I wonder, like, so you decide you're going to write a piece about Aaron Boone. You know he's probably going to be named manager of the Yankees. You're doing a piece on him. How do you even decide who you're going to reach out to?
Well, that one was tricky because it all had to be done before, like, oh, I got an extra hour to do it. But I think it had to be in by like 1 or something in the afternoon on the Saturday because it was for the Sunday paper and all those deadlines are so early. And I had a bunch.
Wait, and you found out about what time? Like, what time would you start on that? Or would you be assigned it or whatever?
I think that story started coming down late the day before. So worked onto that into the evening. And then, you know, with the editor, we talked about, all right, well, we'll need a sort of a profile column for the Sunday paper. I know Aaron, I've known him for a while, and we have a lot of, we see baseball in much the same way, or at least, I mean, he sees it as a player, obviously, he knows a million more times than I do, but I think in terms of recognizing things, recognizing sort of subtle things that other people might not, and also just having a pretty good memory for it. Like, we've always sort of connected over that stuff, and also the Phillies connection, like, you know, his dad playing for the Phillies and me watching the Phillies a lot, but the same era. So we've always had a pretty good relationship, as he does with a lot of media members. So I had a lot of stuff that I could use from my own recollection. And, right. You know, I could text him, you know, here and there, just like, hey, you know, I know we're not talking, but do I remember this accurately? Yes or no? You know, just yes or no or whatever. And you know, but not, you know, giving me information so much as just like, hey, man, I got to do this profile. Do I remember this right? So he helped out with that. But no, I mean, I just, you know, I figured I know Hal and I know Jim Bowden both real well. And I figured that I could get them on short notice that morning. And luckily I figured right about that. And they were both really, really good. I mean, you know, Jim's really good on the, you know, MLB Network Radio and the TV stuff he does. And, you know, he knows how to weave a story and tell an anecdote. And he, you know, he was there for a lot of Boone's career. He was there at the beginning, you know, when he drafted him. So that's always good to get someone from the beginning. And Hal, I knew the story about how much Aaron had talked to him, had helped him out when he was going blind. And I felt like that would be a really good example to serve the purposes both of explaining how he is with the media, which is a big deal in New York, and sort of showing some of his humanity in the fact that he went above and beyond to make a veteran writer feel comfortable in the clubhouse when he was losing his eyesight and to encourage him not to quit. So I, you know, I thought those two could really carry the story. And that's one thing that I get sort of disappointed about sometimes is when columnists just don't make those calls because they don't have to. I mean, like you could just write that column and just give some opinions and maybe a couple of anecdotes that you remember and then that's it. But I really wanted to get at least a couple of voices in there on the record just talking about the guy. And also, you know what? I mean, this is a long answer, but you can't, in a situation like that, you know, they haven't announced it yet, so you can't talk to the Yankees yet on the record about about the guy. And so you just look for educated voices who don't have any invested in it. You know, like they're not making the hire, but they know the people who make the hire and they know the guy who's being hired. You know, like certain before they announce them, some people just can't talk about it. So you just got to go to other people.
Do you do you feel bad for a Joe Girardi when he gets fired? You know, is that part of it? Or do you have a sort of, I don't know, journalistic guard against certain emotions or feeling attachments toward guys or, you know, affection toward guys or et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, no, I think you feel, I don't know, because I generally like people, like almost everyone. I could find something I like about them. And just focus on that. So, yeah, I mean, like, you know, when something unfortunate happens to any of these guys, I do feel something for them personally. I mean, they're at the highest level of the sport and, you know, the far greater percentage of people don't make it, try to make it and don't. So they are, you know, the lucky ones and the successful ones. But even within that, like, you know, we all have ups and downs and deal with disappointments and I feel bad for them in that case. Yeah. I mean, I felt bad for Joe. Joe was never going to be Joe Torre in terms of like giving you real rich quotes and flavorful anecdotes that'll just fill up your story. But Girardi never once questioned the time he needed to spend with us. and the obligation of it, never begged out of it. You know, and I think while he was never like going to be overly helpful to you, like he, I think he's a genuinely good man who always wanted you to succeed in life. I mean, I never felt like he was a bad guy. So, yeah, no, I felt bad for him. I talk about it. I probably should have reached out and sent him a text, but I didn't. Honestly, though, I've never had sex with Girardi, so because I always deal with him like twice a day, you know, at right. the ballpark. But when there's a GM or something or a scout or whatever, and you hear that they lose their job, often I will shoot them a text because they, you know what, man, because they've been helpful to me, and I always feel like these guys they really don't have to be helpful to you. Like I always feel like, you know, they're doing me a favor. By taking time out of their day to help me do my job. So, you know, if they lose theirs, and there's somebody who I've texted with and called in the past, I'll just shoot them a note just to say, hey, man, I'm sorry, you know, sorry to hear that. Good luck, you know, good luck with everything. Cause, these guys do help us out and I want to show gratitude.
I also think we live in particularly mean times. Like I was just thinking when you were talking about that a couple of years ago, I don't know, it was two or three seasons ago, when the Packers had a backup tight end who had a really bad fumble and a kickoff. And moments later on Twitter, you know, there's this like nonstop venom toward this guy. And even today, you know, Marvin Lewis is extended by the Cincinnati Bengals. And you look on Twitter and it's just bashing this guy left and right. Jack Del Rio is fired by the Raiders. People are celebrating. And I always think like behind this all, there's a guy who just lost his job. And whether he's making $1 million or 10 bucks an hour, he still has to go home and tell his family that he lost his job. And, you know, tens, if not hundreds, if not millions of people know that you lost your job and share in to some degree in celebrating your execution. And I just think we have become callous to that. And it always bothers me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. There's a real person behind all that stuff. And, I don't know. I mean, it's just the world's cruel enough, man. I really don't want to take shots at people. You know, I don't know. I just generally don't like taking shots at people because I don't like the process of defending it. And I don't like just putting more negativity out there if I don't have to. And I always just give people the benefit of the doubt. I'm probably naive in that sense, but I always assume that everybody out there is trying their best and is worthy of, you know, worthy of respect.
Yep, I agree. Final question for you here. I have another story in front of me. December 20th, 2017, another Florida star departs as the Rays trade Evan Longoria. And I wonder when you are when you're writing about a guy getting traded. Or a deal, a transaction of some sort. Are you, this sounds not a poetic way of putting it. Are you looking for the reason behind the deal? What I mean is when the Yankees acquired Giancarlo Stanton, are you trying to figure out what the Marlins are thinking? How much of it is digging behind the trade to figure out what made up the trade? And how much is the surface reporting of the trade and what it means to the teams?
Well, I think, if I'm doing my job right, I should be able to explain to the readers why something happened. So, you know, yeah, that requires digging. That requires knowledge of the industry and the motivations of every team. And, you know, because a lot of times people just don't pay close enough attention. It's not their job. I mean, you know, like me, I like the NFL or the NBA, but I don't pay close enough attention to understand the motivation for every deal that happens that might catch my attention. So, you know, I feel like a lot of times you're writing for those casual fans as well. You can't dumb it down too much, but you need to be able to explain and you know, easily to understand language why some deal went down. And I feel like that's my strength because I don't, you know, we don't, people who, you know, my bosses don't prioritize me finding out the six teams that are interested in Lance Lynn right now. You know what I mean? It's not like, that's not how I spend my time and energy. But when a Lance Lynn signs, I need to be able to understand why and, you know, how that impacts everything. So I feel like that's my that's what I can do best in those situations. And then like that day when a trade was made, happened pretty early in the day, and it was official pretty early in the day, so you could start, find out more about it. And then they have some people on conference calls and whatnot, and they just put it together. But I also look for, in that day, I try to look for something beyond just like what that deal means. And one of the first things I thought of was, man, you know, like that's two giant stars traded from the two Florida teams, and these two teams can never quite find their footing in MLB. You know, they both came in the 90s. They both really struggled to draw. They have had some success. It hasn't been total failure, but they, you know, they just can't quite have that sustainable model. Something's always a little bit wrong there. So, you know, I try to just twin them up.
Right. As soon as that trade happened, the first thing I thought was, this guy's going from the worst stadium in baseball, playing inside a giant tuna. I really did. I thought, that's probably what I'd write about, going from like playing in the Tropicana Field, which is the worst stadium anywhere, to beautiful, lovely San Francisco.
That's funny. Yeah.
You know, it's like, what a great change for that guy.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that's something I'd like to do too. And that, you know, you find, if you know enough about baseball, if you're deep into it enough and you love it enough, or any subject, you can find connections like that. That really help you out. I mean, if I weren't able to sort of intuitively make connections between various players or events or teams or whatever, the job would be a lot harder. And I feel like I have a little bit of an edge sometimes because I remember a lot of stuff about baseball. I don't know why, and I just, you know, I think about it way too much probably. But what that does is sometimes when something happens, I can pretty quickly kind of think of something else it relates to, and then maybe talk to a person like that. Like for example, like a couple of years ago, the Giants were down 3-1 to St. Louis in the LCS, and they would need a row for the second series in a row to advance because they had just done it against the Reds. And in that clubhouse, I'm thinking like, boy, you know, the only team I can remember that's ever, you know, won three in a row, you know, had three must-win games back-to-back series and done it was the 85 Royals, because they fell down 3-1 in both series in the LCS and the World Series. And I'm like, man, who could I get on the 85 Royals right now? And it's late. And I'm like, oh, my God, there's Steve Balboni standing in the hallway because he's like he was a scout for the Giants or whatever. And so like, I could go up and talk to Steve Balboni about that experience. And so, you know, if I weren't able to like recall that stuff like right away, you know, it would make life a lot harder.
Man, it's so funny. We speak the same language. Yeah. I'm always thinking
about Steve Balboni, right?
I assure you. Well, I can tell you first of all, I wore number 45 with the Yankees. He and Don Mattingly were the two first basemen of the future for the Yankees. They traded into Kansas City. It was really a debate at first whether the Yankees made the right move trading Balboni and keeping Mattingly. I just yeah, I'm sort of like you. I'm a geek.
Oh yeah, I'm very proud of that. I mean, I'm
me too.
A baseball nerd.
Me too. Yeah, me too. Well, listen, Tyler, I truly thank you for doing this, and I am I'm a huge admirer of your work, and you know, happy to see you sort of thriving and surviving in the business. So, good luck in book world. It's a nice place to be.
Yeah, thanks, man. No, you're a great great example of that, and I really do love it. I mean, I love this. This process, it can be daunting, but thankfully I got a lot of time to do it, and I just can't wait till the thing comes out. Then you've had that experience, 10 times or so of having your own book come out? And,
yeah, a couple. Eight.
Yeah. So anyway, good luck to you with that USFL book, man. Can't wait.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, thanks, Tyler.
All right, man.
Take care.
See you. Bye.
I want to thank today's guest, Tyler Kepner, for joining me on Two Writers Sling and Yang. You can follow Tyler on Twitter at Tyler Kepner and read his stuff in the New York Times. One can listen to Two Writers Sling and Yang on both iTunes and Anchor.fm. Reviews are always appreciated. Music by MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.